Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's not Chamberlain's fault. Here's why I say that, because there are POV shots from Chamberlain's perspective when he's under this bridge. It's the director's fault. The director went for this. He told him, act insane, and I'm going to get this shot of you looking up at the bridge while you're spinning around and slapping your ass cheeks. It doesn't make any sense, man. Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun, the 1980 miniseries on NBC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And this is part two of our discussion. We've now seen the first half of this tale, this particular telling of it. Aaron, what did you think of the second episode? I know we both kind of had pretty, you know, glowing opinions generally of this 1980 adaptation of the novel. How about now?
Had a lot of kind comments about how they were handling things and the acting and the writing and everything with the costuming and the sets.
And the music.
And the music. Oh, Jesus. And it doesn't get any better.
We're about to talk about that. Yeah.
This is where, honestly, this was a very bewildering experience for me. And I can't, like, this is where the wheels start to fall off on not giving any Japanese people interiority, because it seems like there's a couple of differences between the 80 series and the 24 series, the FX series, and it seems like a lot of these deviations are the 80s is maybe more accurate to the book from scene to scene, but I don't know if I agree with all those adaptation choices. And the other thing where the 24 and 80 difference is, it seems like when the 1980s didn't have the budget to pull off like the cliff rescue scene, they didn't have the budget for that, so they compressed it. And unfortunately, all of those changes in this particular episode just really undercut some of the tension, because there's a lot of stuff that happens like the map, the garden scene where he draws the map, like that is essentially shot for shot remake. There was a couple things, but then there's a scene where when I saw it, you know, we our Toranaga, the FX Toranaga, is a very reserved, very serious, very sober, a student of human behavior, knows how to manipulate and cajole, And he's also a person who realizes that he's having a hard time keeping this coalition together. Half of his people want to commit suicide all the time, and it's extremely frustrating for him to hold. You don't get any. This Toranaga, at some point, the equivalent of Toranaga making the Anjin teach him how to dive. Is him being taught this naval ditty. And when Toranaga starts doing this dance with Blackthorn, I tweeted that it felt like watching Gus Fring do the Macarena.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like this very serious, very calculating, like person is just doing something that makes him look like a fool. And
it was...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it is bad enough in that one scene where he's teaching it to him, but they do a callback to it that makes it seven times worse.
Yeah. And just a lot of they continue to fully develop the Europeans and their fractions and their alliances, but not knowing what's going on, that there's so many subtleties that are missed, and there's so many, and we'll probably detail them all, but yeah, this was a less satisfying version of the adaptation. It doesn't completely break down, but oh man, Mariko as a character, just without knowing and like all these things that we see happen, like you know, Fuji's family's death, that's all just relayed to us, and you just like, you're forgiven to think that Torunaga is just running this death cult, like this, like, you know, like he's Immortan Joe in Mad Max Fury Road, and he's just, you know, everybody just killing him, oh, mediocre. But then he's also this like very much warmer, friendlier, approachable person in this version. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a lot of broken neck, like whiplash from the coming off of the characterization of Torunaga as we saw him in this one. But there's other stuff too.
I don't think I would mind those shades of warmth to him and approachability. It's just they take it too far, and they take a lot of things too far in this. I think the way that they handled the language kind of being picked up by Blackthorn over the course mm-hmm. of his stay here in Japan was much more graceful in the 2024 edition. Here yeah. they have scenes explicitly of him learning and being taught and educated by Mariko, and that stuff, while I think the scenes largely served a dual purpose, they also felt like they dragged. And a lot of things went on too long, especially, my God, the scene where he has to act insane to cover the fact that Torunaga is escaping Osaka Castle. From the music to the acting to the length of that scene, it all just comes across as silly.
Yeah,
there's no tension there because he's just being stupid.
And it reduces Ishido to Colonel Klink status.
Yeah, that's the thing. He's doing it directly with Ishido as well, which is different from the 2024 version, where it's just kind of an underling who he might be able to bamboozle. But I hated that scene. I thought it was way too long and worse somehow. And I talked about in the 2024 version how I don't truck with those types of scenes because they make everybody involved look stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I had no concept of how stupid you could look, apparently, because they make him look 20 times stupider and everyone around him look even dumber than in the 2024 version. So,
and it also, like, I got a lot more appreciation for how much Easter eggs and respect they were showing the 2024 version was showing the 80s, because they took Blackthorn in 80s, like, legitimate disgust about how women are just, you know, like some of that, like, verbiage line by line is used in the modern version, where Cosmo will say he's acting insane, but he's using that same dialogue, the, like, you know, the women, oh, the shame of it, so they're doing an homage to the 80s, but it's so much better.
Yeah, it's way tighter because he's not just being a clown. He's not causing, you know, a visual distraction here that's going to catch the eye of people. He's doing something a little deeper. At least there's a thought in his head about what's going on here.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I hated that scene. I hate the music in it. I think it's like clown shit.
No, it's terrible. It's literally clown shit. And there's like, the music of this miniseries is just god awful. Like, this thing would be so much better if you just rescore it, you know, with something that approaches the sophistication and seriousness which the rest of the series is developing. But I don't know. I suspect a lot of these are more accurate to the book. And then some of them, like, we got screwed out of our thrilling race between the Anjin and Rodriguez much stupider way to resolve it. But it also is something that you can resolve in a Hollywood dunk tank where you can't. So like I said, I it's an 80s miniseries, but even judging by that, these next 2 hours of Shogun Part 2, and we end, just so if you're keeping up and at home, we end essentially with the little switcheroo that Mariko plays on Blackthorn, where she sleeps with him and then says it's just one of my servant girls. That's how we end this evening. But it's much less successful than the first one, in my opinion. Do you want to go through point by point and talk about it?
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. We'll be right back.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose!
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. And now, back with more Bald Move.
Because I want to start, the big difference is they continue to just emphasize the brutality and the meaningless violence. And they do that as Blackthorne's being let out of jail. There is just teams of young people, vulnerable people crucified along the road that he walks to Toranaga. And this is just, this is just Orientalism. This is just, look how savage and we stopped crucifying people 100 years ago. Look at how barbaric it is, you know?
I will give them one point here for seemingly using actual Japanese actors. Like, it almost surprised me that in 1980 there weren't a few people in some heavy makeup or, you know, some Mexicans or whoever in the background there. You know, not on the close-ups, but no, everybody seems to be relatively, at least from the region, I would say.
Yeah, and I think, again, the sins are mostly sins of innocence and ignorance and, you know, strict adaptation rather than, like, nothing felt pretty malicious. But it's just, I mean, we've gone 45 years down. And also you got to think from the other perspective is, like, in the early 80s, this is only, like, 30-ish years, past World War II and Korea, where, like, there's a lot of probably Americans that have their own biases and axes to grind against. It's like, you know, this is, for my accounts, is an extremely progressive cultural appreciation moment for the United States. It's just we've also made 45 years of progress, and
but there are a lot of extras in these scenes and they all seem to fit right in, so good for
them. This leads right into the garden scene where Toranaga's inviting him with Mariko as a translator and asking about the shape of the world. And this goes down exactly how it does in this year, the 2024 miniseries.
Yep.
I will say one other thing, a bugaboo that bugged me throughout this episode. If you're in a fucking Japanese garden in this show, you're never going to wonder, even if your eyes are closed, because wind chimes. The wind chimes will be playing incessantly throughout these scenes, day or night. There's going to be like sitting on your grandma's front porch.
Yep.
And a summer breeze. Oh, my God.
How could I not notice this? Wind chime?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. You've got the same sound system I have. How did you not hear the perfect surround sounds tinkling of these wind chimes?
I don't know. And wind chimes are my mortal enemy. I strongly dislike wind chimes. I don't know how I didn't notice it.
Maybe you just blocked it out.
Yeah. I don't even think about wind chimes. The air. Sorry. The air has some extraordinarily bad hair in this. I got to say, the wigs are getting worse. Mm. You think over the life of a production, the costuming and stuff will get better? No.
Well, and there's one close up of Mariko where you can clearly see the webbing of her. Yeah. And I'm like, and you mentioned that, like, I really saw in Yabu the bald cap scene, but I forget that this was in night. we are watching a high def scan of the 16 millimeter print, and these people were watching this on 320.
Yeah,
bullshit. Like, they probably honestly could not see any of these flaws that are quite obvious. So, like, I started, okay, well, yeah, the wig kind of looks god-awful. But we made
the thing in 1980. The thing was made. Like, effects. But it was designed
to be projected on a 35-foot screen and 35-millimeter. That's true. This one
was
not
a TV movie, yeah.
So the next scene, we get the ship, the black cap, the ship, the captain of the black ship. Discussing that he's going to leave whether he has the permission of Torunaga or not. He briefly discusses assassinating Torunaga. What was your impression? You know, what was your impression as a 2024 veteran seeing this Spanish-Portuguese intrigue?
Oh, I liked it. Yeah, I thought explaining this stuff was way better. I don't know what they're going to do with it in this particular adaptation. I hope it goes somewhere a little bit bigger by the end, but I appreciate it.
It did seem like they're, and I don't know what the book is more, but it seemed like the priests are being a little whitewashed. Like, they're a little bit like genuinely holy, and it's these merchant mercenaries that are forcing their hand into things.
I don't know, because the thing that really, I guess, stuck with me in this scene is that line about trust, right? They are here essentially because of the trust that the Japanese have in them. And if the black captain of the black ship goes off and starts murdering lords, that trust is gone and the Christians are gone. So it's a little bit self-serving, and I see that. So I didn't feel like it was too whitewashed, but like,
well, they also
serve a god who believes that they shouldn't be murdering people. So, like, they're kind of torn, you know?
But it just seems like, yeah, that these priests have been here for a long time. As Father Martin explains, he was born in this country, speaks it like a native. Mm. And then they establish that the black ship's captain is his first tour.
Yeah.
So he's just like, let's just take he refers to them as monkeys. Refers to Torunaga as a monkey to his face.
Right.
It's in fucking insane.
Yeah, and they correct him.
Right. And they also, the priest threatened him with excommunication, which backs him up on his heels briefly.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
But yeah, the priests seem a lot more cautious and less willing to throw their political weight around because they know, like, what a bad... But also, there's a lot of, like... I'm halfway through this series, and I do not understand the situation between Ishido and Torunaga.
Huh.
I have no idea about Mariko's backstory.
Yeah, boy, now that you mention it.
It's like, I get this is, that's why I keep going back to the David Lynch Dune, where it's like, I understand because I saw this thing that laid it all out much better. But like, it's like, there's really no reason, you know, Mariko says things like, Ishido won't let my lord out of the castle. Well, why? And then it's like, he's resigning from the council. You find out that the existence of the council the first time the Torunaga resigns from it.
Right.
And, you know, like, yeah, all that stuff, the Japanese side is just kind of like a mystery. And Mariko has got such a airhead persona. And I don't know whether it's because she is very stereotypical in her accent where, you know, she's transposing L's and R's everywhere. But like, she just really seems like not just ignorant about a lot of stuff and accepting about, you know, life and death is same, Anjin. But also kind of like naive and uncurious about it too.
I really think it comes down to we don't see the internal lives of these people.
Right.
It's like by this time when she's saying that life and death is the same, I know who this person is. I understand how she thinks. Here, all I've seen her do is be a translator. So I don't. Yeah. I don't know if she believes the things she's saying. I don't know if they are important to her or she is like a woman outside of culture who feels distraught by this whole thing. I couldn't tell you in this show.
Yeah.
But she's trying to teach him lessons that I'm not sure she even believes or understands. But the 2024 version is way better in that regard. And it really sticks out in a lot of scenes where the narrator has to come in a lot in this episode or this part, because otherwise we wouldn't understand the dynamics, like especially in that scene where Torunaga rolls up to Yabu's army and gets them sort of sways them to his side, gets their allegiance. They have to really lean heavy on the narrator, and I don't think it's nearly as effective because I understood intuitively what was happening in the 2024 version there. Here, the narrator has to explain it.
There's no show, not tell. The narrator always has to come in because you, why would
they
you
show
this?
It, but you wouldn't understand it without the narrator telling you. Yeah.
Right. So in the 2024 series, Blackthorn is staying in Toranaga's quarters and a lady assassin shows up to try to kill him. And they explained that, they know it wasn't at Blackthorn. It was that is completely absent from the show. Instead, a shinobi attack, which I thought was actually really cool. Those scenes of the ninja kind of running along the rooftops at night and blending climbing into the shadows, very parkour, was very thrilling and exciting. But like all that, like, you know, you get that early glimpse of Toranaga as this sly fox, and it's missing. You know, like they didn't transpose places. He didn't try to draw out Shido's true intentions. And it follows in the next day of the Yabu where Orson Welles has to come in and be like, Toranaga had to ask who would know how to hire a shinobi, and Yabu is on the short list. So he invited him to a dawn breakfast, and Yabu knew that he was on a short leash.
Mm-hmm.
And that's and you said I'd warm up the Yabu. Kinda.
Sorta. This is not it yet, but maybe.
He's definitely got more of like the energy of the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where he's like kind of incompetent and buffoonish and overreaching. And it's so funny because like I think a fair description of our Yabushiga as well. But it's just without any of the things that make Yabushiga charming and appealing.
Yeah, it's relatable. Really hard to get inside that bubble with Yabu. In this version of it.
So the next day, then again, there's no reason for why Toranaga suddenly takes a shine to Blackthorn, but Blackthorn is entertaining these three pillowing ladies that he's been provided. And he's just drinking with them, and he gets in his cups enough, and he has enough sake that he gets up and starts dancing this naval jig. And Toranaga walks in, and instead of being like, stop this buffoonery at once, he's like, oh, this is an interesting dance. Teach me. And they spend 5 minutes teaching Toranaga how to line dance to a hornpipe.
The same dance we just saw, in its entirety. They do the dance twice, maybe three times. And look, I wouldn't have necessarily minded Toranaga having a bit more personality and being
and curiosity for the barbarian culture as much as, you know, some exchange.
Sure. I could see that. They take it too far here, much like they do with everything. They make Toranaga look almost foolish.
Well, and they do. It goes both sides too, because like there is a scene where Blackthorn is so obtuse about the notion of pillowing. Like, I remember our Blackthorn being like, you know, he's clearly not familiar with the metaphor, but he's like, she starts to explain, our Mariko starts explaining to John Blackthorn, and he's like, I get it. I'm not an idiot. I can understand the context. This Blackthorn's like pillowing. I don't understand. And she has to like labor to explain to him what she's talking about. And then... You know, I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay, let me ask you this, because this Sakazuki scene, he can't quite get it right, where he's drinking a whole bunch. He seems very willing over the course of this part to engage in drinking, heavy drinking, to engage in eating to the point of passing out. Like, he's making himself sick by eating. He is completely unwilling to even approach the idea of having sex. Why is that? Because I don't get the feeling like in the 2024 version, I felt like it was because he had the hots for Mariko in particular. In this, I don't feel any of that coming into this scene.
I think this is good old fashioned Orientalism, where it's just like, the Japanese had slightly different ideas of modesty and sex, so let's really juxtaposition that with our like puritanical American ideas.
I guess
that are probably ahistoric.
Yeah,
but yeah, he's essentially like, oh, that's like, you know, I feel about that. And he lets Mariko be like, you know, oh, Engine, we see things all differently. And I don't know.
But all of that is resolved also, when he gets when he gets Mariko. It's like, okay, so clearly sex is not your problem, I guess. It's Mariko in particular that you're hot for.
Well, it also lets him really grandstand about how he's not gay. He's not a goddamn sodomite. Yeah. Because when she's like, well, you know, like if these ladies aren't to your liking, you know, we'll get you other. There'll be no offense. And he's like, oh, it's not that. It's not that. And she's like, oh, what if you like boys? And he's like, whoa, and he just gets all in high offense about that. Did you notice how people walk super fast on this show?
Super fast? I see Toranaga walking and I think, oh, yeah. They definitely took a page out of that book.
I thought I first noticed it when the heir's mother, the nun, comes out for the ceremony. And I'm primed for watching our Shogun that she's going to, you know, do these careful 6-inch steps to make sure she doesn't. And she just and I'm like, oh, she probably barely speaks English and she just blew the mark and whatever. But everyone in this show walks like they're in a speed walking competition. And I don't know whether it just like makes it look more fast and intense, but everybody just as they're walking to and from this particular scene I'm talking about is you see Father Martin walking with a Japanese honor guard. And he's just like, they're just all just walking so fast. It's really jarring compared to what we're coming from.
They got a lot of dancing to shoot. They don't have time to be shooting people walking.
So the next scene we have is Toranaga sneaking out of Osaka Castle, which we do not understand why this is happening. We don't understand that Toranaga is here against his will because he's always been presented to us as like the high king of Japan. And
they do
like
say,
their high
you know, nobody leaves Osaka Castle except with Ishido's permission.
But I don't think we find that out until Mariko is explaining why he did this, which happens after the scene.
Oh, maybe so. Yeah.
And we also meet Bentaro for the first time here, and Bentaro's like 3 foot tall. Did you notice how short of?
Oh, I didn't see. No,
he's very slight, and he's very brutish and commanding and officious.
This scene also starts really weird, maybe it's slightly after this, but they introduce like the sides here with subtitles or captions, right? It's like the Browns, Toranaga's samurai, the Grays, Ishido's samurai, and it's like, boy, you have no faith in your audience whatsoever in 1980.
Right. But again, we have not even seen Ishido yet. We will see Ishido when he comes to meet the lady. And it's also this, that's the thing. It's like, this didn't play out as a cat and mouse game. This plays out as Toranaga trying to sneak out of the castle, and Ishido, because he's got a note that he wants to pass to another lady, just kind of like, oh, but before you go, my lady, will you take the... And maybe it is that this is a surprise inspection, but none of that complexity really plays off through here.
And it makes... It doesn't feel right, because he's doing this directly to Ishido, and I think that's a huge mistake. Like... Ishido would just chop his fucking head off if he started dancing around like a lunatic here, because we don't know, we don't understand like of what value is
when
this
you say dancing around like
to
a lunatic
council. Oh, literally, like he's trying to act like he's insane, like he's lost his mind.
Yeah, he's like slapping his head and making crazy noises and jumping up and down like a literal ape and
it's
doing
so
capering
stupid.
And then
he's not just making a fuss. He's not grandstanding here. He's acting
crazy.
It's not
played off as a cultural misunderstanding.
No.
He's just a psychotic. And Ishido is trying to kill him. He's trying to kill him with a bow. And Mariko shields him with her body.
Well, he's standing there. When he starts this, he's standing there with a sword, right? Ishido could have just chopped his head off. And the point I'm getting to is we have no idea of what value Blackthorn would ever be to the council, to Toranaga, to anyone. Whereas in the 2024 version, we've seen the council has a Christian faction, and they are interested in this Blackthorn guy.
Yes.
And Ishido might not be able to kill him, but even in the new version, they make it, they're smart enough not to make it Ishido that he's acting a fool in front of, because Ishido would just kill him.
Right. And the other thing is that they make it like a really, like that Toranaga outfoxed a very clever Ishido, whereas this Ishido is played again like Colonel Klink, because at the end, it's like, it's not like he ever gets, the guy just grabs a note out of his hand and shoves it in Toranaga's window and then acts like a crazy person until, I guess, Ishido gets befuddled because there's kind of like a, at the end.
And but Toranaga's, it just makes him look incompetent. Just decide to start walking and nobody stops him. So,
And I think if Chamberlain did like pulled back on the crazy and played it like a menacing, he almost got there. There's one point where Ishido looks like he's going to kill him, and like he insults Blackthorn, and Blackthorn gets this like serious psychotic, but then he just goes right back into crazy man. And like you said, it lasts. I feel like he's halfway to the fucking Anjiro before he stops. And Mariko's like, they can't see us anymore. Stop it.
And, oh, thank God. It's not Chamberlain's fault. Here's why I say that, because there are POV shots from Chamberlain's perspective when he's under this bridge. It's the director's fault. The director went for this. He told him, act insane, and I'm going to get this shot of you looking up at the bridge while you're spinning around and slapping your ass cheeks. It doesn't make any sense, man.
Yeah.
And the music, I cannot stress how god awful this clown music is. It's like you're on a Ferris wheel. It's terrible.
I think that these segments were directed by different people, different men, undoubtedly, too.
Oh, you think so?
And I want to think, because there's such a drop off in quality and subtlety between this episode and last that it's like, I wasn't able to verify that independently, but I'm going to chalk it up at that. So this leads to the conversation where we find out Mariko's a Christian. And in this, she's a lot less conflicted. In this, she's a Christian, yes, but she's Japanese first. So her loyalties are never in doubt, and they're very clear. And there's, like, it's not that she doubts Blackthorn. It's just that the things that he's telling her about the state of the world and his intelligence just don't make sense to her understanding, because they didn't even know that there was people other than the Portuguese and the Spanish. They didn't know that there's a schism in the Christian world right now. They don't. So, like, yeah, like her confusion, I think, played as genuine, whereas Mariko's was more, I guess, a positive rejection. Like, no, I know you're lying, because these people would never do that, other than, like, what you're telling me doesn't make any sense. Like, I can't.
Yeah, I like that. I don't want this to turn into just completely bashing part two here in favor of 2024 version, because I do think there are things that they're getting at that make a lot of sense. This idea of her being Christian but Japanese first. There's a belief system there, right? Like, she believes in the Japanese societal structure more than she currently believes in the Christian God. And until she can resolve that conflict, she is what she started as. She's Japanese.
And they never, may it'll come later because it did in the series, but they never get around to the eightfold fence. She does talk about how
the
Japanese have no privacy, so they find it within themselves. But it's interesting, because I also thought it was, I forgot to talk about this yesterday, but Rodriguez mentions the three hearts, but the six faces.
Yeah, yeah.
You get eight less fences, six more faces, and the same three hearts in both series.
Yeah, so we really only lose a couple of fences. They do that scene in all but name, right? Like, they don't name the eight fences, the eightfold fence. Mm.
But I kept on waiting. Like, I thought that had to be a term, but maybe that's something where Clavel was familiar with the philosophy but didn't know the proper name for it, and then they came back and that. Or maybe it's in the book and this was like, eightfold fence, that sounds, we're already too artsy fartsy Eastern here. I thought it was interesting that the attack on them going to Anjiro, like, instead of happening in the like a forest, it just happens in the city.
Yeah,
and that's just like undoubtedly a location cost saving thing. And again, the acting of physical trauma is all over this place. Like, I never know when someone gets hit by an arrow whether they're going to make a fucking Wilhelm scream meal out of it or act like a normal person shot with an arrow. It's just like all over the place.
Yeah, we don't get to see Bentaro being a badass in this sequence of scenes here, which I think is unfortunate because that really set him up and helped with his likability in some rough stuff to come, I think.
Oh, yeah. And the whole escape to the galley scene was bizarre. It's this like Toranaga taking this slow roll through the city, completely unhurried, unperturbed, almost to like a suicidal, stupid degree, rather than this desperate fight that after they've been found, this running battle to get to the galley before they're killed. Yeah, it's just almost played off as a joke. And Chamberlain's like, look at Mr. Toranaga, all the time in the world. And
they don't even give us the insight into the quote unquote bandits and who sent them.
No.
Right? I mean, you could maybe surmise, but that's a pretty big leap to make in this version.
Well, they also put it to where Hiromatsu, as soon as he leaves the castle that evening, goes to the council and says, my lord resigned your regents. Now, this is the first time we heard about the regents. And they have to do some high speed explaining. But no, we don't even know what that means. Like, it'll be explained by Mariko later. But like, it plays because then the escape to the galley scene happens after that. So it almost seems like Toranaga is doing like a Marco Ramius from Red October, where he sends the letter that they're defecting as they leave. So the whole fleet's going to be like, Toranaga's like, hey, I'm piecing out of the castle. As I'm piecing out of the castle, so it's like Ishido sends out the entire guard when he finds that out. So it's like a self-inflicted, like, wound of arrogance or pride.
It could be, yeah. We don't have a lot of insight into it. I will say I'm not very impressed with Ishido so far as like what he's tasked with doing. All he does is look bewildered. You know, he comes out to meet them at the gates. The guy acts crazy. He looks bewildered. He gets the letter from Hiromatsu about the resignation. He looks bewildered.
Yeah.
I see nothing from this man that should make me fear or consider him at all.
Yeah, it's Colonel. Well, to be fair, we're not seeing much from Toranaga too, but it's very Colonel Klink. I know nothing. It's just, he just doesn't have a handle on anything going on in the city.
Also, the damage they're doing to Mariko's character. Again, I don't want this to just be shitting on this version, but she faints when she sees the attackers come toward the boat. She fucking faints.
Rather than picking up a Nagakata and just going to work, mowing fools down, she's just like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. That is not the Mariko I know. Also, Mariko thanks Blackthorn for saving her life. That's also not the Mariko I know. She should be thanking, or he should be thanking her for having such awesome skills.
Yeah, and you can, like, there's a lot of, I saw on the subreddit and then, like, on Twitter that people were taking issue with these warrior women. And the fact of the matter is, the Japanese has a long history of female samurai and warrior women. It's going to come to an end. Like, this Japanese society is going to calcify over these next couple hundred years, and it will become to the point in the late Edo period where women fighting is very much not a thing. And but like, it's, you got these weeaboos that have watched like Samurai Champloo and think they understand what the fuck is going on, and then they're like, oh, let me tell you about how these women fighting in this and 1601 is completely ahistorical, and you know, there's the random, like, like literally one link to Wikipedia, you could educate yourself. But yeah, Mariko just fainting.
It's crazy. Ridiculous. Yeah.
So then we have the scene where the black ship. Why didn't we give this show and the book and the FX series more shit for calling the bad guy's boat the black ship? Like, why not just call it the evil boat and get it over with? Why the fuck would this trades thing be called the black ship? Like, Davy Jones is on it, and he's taking your immortal soul to hell. The black ship captain is a cartoon character.
Oh, yeah. Farrier.
Judge Doom and Roger Rabbit would give him the dip. He's just like, he looks like Faces of Meth William Shakespeare with the hair and the makeup and the giant pleated shit. Yeah, Elizabethan shit.
He gets the collar in this version, which is interesting.
Yeah. And they're talking, and he's just like,
oh, please let me kill them. It's the Tornag is right there and I've got the gun. And the priests are like, absolutely no killing, no political interference, no fun. Like, what is this? And the thing that happens in the 2024 series happens on board the Black Ship, where Toranaga parlays and essentially trades Blackthorn's life for his own, except for instead of passage on the Black Ship, because apparently, again, they don't have the budget to do a ship race. It's Blackthorn makes an offhand comment. It's like, what we need is 20 muskets so we can just blast our way through here. So Toranaga just goes and asks for 20 muskets.
Yeah.
He trades a church in Edo and Blackthorn for 20 muskets. And you're asking, well, without the race, how the hell does Blackthorn get away? Well, John Rhys Davies, because he's overheard this whole thing, grabs Blackthorn, pretends he said something unkind about his mother, and threw him over the ship. And yeah. Blackthorn just swims to Toranaga's vessel.
It's hard to believe, too, because this is the scene where Blackthorn has gorged himself to the point of passing out on turkey and potatoes and carrots and shit.
Yeah.
So they throw him in the water. They have to drag his ass up from the floor and get him to the deck. And then they throw him in the water. I'm like, well, he's dead. Unless somebody jumps in here to save him, he can't. He's too full to swim. He's half dead.
Yeah.
And he just starts power swimming right over to the boat.
And the captain of the Black Ship is just like, I can do nothing. He's 20 yards off my bow. I can do. There's none of the subtle of like, well, they're Christians, so they won't fire in a Christian ship. And then here is the foregleam of the chief stupidity and ahistoricalness of the Japanese just not understanding firearms, because these 20 guns are just going to like they just shoot these archers down. There's nothing they can do about it. And I'm like,
I thought that was kind of better handled than this, you know. You don't have a scene where Blackthorn has to swim back over to the boat and teach these 20 guys how to use the muskets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is almost what they did in the 2024 version.
Well, they do it in the 1980. We'll get there. The other thing is, like, this is the first mention. This is halfway through the second episode, the first mention of Macau.
Yes.
But it's not like it's next port of call. You know, we don't understand
nothing
the significance.
About
now,
it.
To be fair, it doesn't seem like there's that much significance to the story, but I thought that was interesting.
No, even in the 2024 version, I expected it to come back and it never did. So it's almost better that it's just, like you said, next port of call.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. And now, back with more Bald Move.
We go back to Enjiro, like we do in the 2024 series, and we meet Omi. And for the first time, I realized that Omi has this crossed axe motif on his chest. Like, every robe he wears has got a different version of the same, like, axe gang pattern. I thought that was kind of cool. But
the Erasmus is not being held in Injiro. He's moved it with the crew to Edo. Which that makes a lot more sense.
Did that not happen here in the 2024 version? I thought...
No, it stayed in Injiro the whole time.
Yeah, his crew was moved, though.
Was what's moved that to, was the thing. To yeah. Edo. But... it makes more sense that Tornagon moved the whole thing to his stronghold. But it's a useful misdirection because it being out in that bay had us up until the final episode thinking, oh, that's going to be the key that Tornagon. Yeah. And it turns out it's not. The other thing I noticed is what a small, pathetic army the Izu province army is in this version. It's like 30 dudes.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing of. I said this, I think, when we were watching the 2024 version. I can't tell if this is a big army until later I see the real big army come in, right? With Toranaga.
But this you can tell it's not a big... This is a platoon. A platoon of samurai.
Yeah, yeah. And this is really undermined by the storytelling here, you know, with the narrator not doing subtitles. This scene was so powerful in the 2024 version. This sort of switching of allegiances.
Toranaga winning... over the crowd and doing the hi hi ho.
Yes.
And we just get that in the other version. This version, Orson Welles got to come on and be like, you know, Toranaga knew that he had to, that Yabu was too ambitious and he had to cut him down to size, but he also knew that he had to build him back up. And then he presents him these gifts of swords that Yabu just takes like a child. Like, oh my God, it's so. And he gives Blackthorns his pistols personally, which, you know, fair enough.
He doesn't... The one small change, I don't think it matters, but I noted it. He doesn't personally make JB his Hatamoto here. He just kind of gives a letter, it sails off, gives a box, you don't know what's in it. And then JB's almost not even going to open it. He's just like walking with this box. Mariko's like, aren't you going to fucking open the box, dude? You just got Lord Toranaga's special gift. You're not even curious. And so he opens it and it's his guns. And then this letter says, yeah, you're the Hatamoto now.
Does it actually say Hatamoto? Because I thought that like the first time he says I'm a Hatamoto later in the episode, that's the first. I'm like, how would a person understand what the fuck that is?
Because they don't really explain it. That here. Yeah. That word. Because Mariko just says, oh, he made you a very important, you know, a place of respect within his house or whatever.
So there's this other scene where Yabu, there's a scene where like he puts all the village on notice that like you got 6 months to for the Anjin to become a Japanese person, or I'm going to have you all crucified and your homes burnt. And his whole affect here is like, I got my notes that Yabu is funny. I decided halfway through this episode, but he's funny in like a Mo Howard from Three Stooges or like a Joe Pesci from Home Alone, where he's full of himself and but he's deep down kind of a buffoon. And that veneer of I'm the man in control is easily shattered, which is, I feel like I'm describing our Yabu, but it's just, it's a difference
there. That's
it's prestige versus pulp, I guess.
But this boy, this is something he can't live with, as we'll see here in a little bit.
What do you think of the introduction of Fuji? Because she comes, you know, now he's a Hatamoto. He gets the house. He gets the consort. He gets the pistols and swords.
This you know, is completely lacking the context for these Japanese characters, because Fuji is extremely conflicted about this in the 2024 version. In this version, it seems like, well, it's her duty and she's happy to do it. You know,
and she's also played like a sex pot. Like, she's extremely attractive, very made up, and they helpfully let us know that she's only 19. John Blackthorn, he's and it's like and Mariko just like, Lord Toranaga had her husband and child put to death for an embarrassment with Ishito, and it's like. And JB's like, oh my God, Toranaga did this? He's like, yes, the death and life are the same thing. And it just seems like it just makes them seem like they're in a crazy death cult. Like, if you thought the Japanese were portrayed as being in a crazy death cult in the 2024 version, get a load of this shit.
Totally.
Because there's not, like, Mariko has nothing going on behind her eyes in this. Like, she's just,
or above them. What did they do to poor Mariko's forehead with this wig? It's like a crescent moon sliver of a forehead. It damn near touches her eyebrows.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's horrible.
And she even says, he's like, well, I don't want a consort. He's like, well, then, yeah, treat her as nothing. And the second that she offends you, just kill her. And Mariko's not saying this is like, because like Mariko would say some of this stuff in the modern things, but she would have an affect that lets her know what she's really thinking, or like what would be the correct thing, or, you know, like, well, you can do that if you want to be like Yabu, but if you want to, and this is just like, no, this is, yeah, like, and he even, you know, they have the same conversation about their husband. It's like, she's like, of course, it's my life is for him to give away. And it just seems far more insane. This is the other crazy thing. John Blackthorne in the 2024 version threatens to commit seppuku at the end of his life, or at the end of his journey. Here, he's just so outraged that Yabu's going to put them under collective punishment for his dumbass that he threatens suicide, and Yabu saves him.
Yeah, it's for the same general reason, but it's for two different people. And Yabu, I think, demonstrates how sort of interested he is in death here in this scene, because when, you know, he volunteers, says, I can't live with this, I would have to kill myself, Yabu's like, oh, how would you kill yourself? And I don't know if that's Yabu just being like, oh, I'd like to see how the white man kills themselves, or if he's doing a similar test, like, how Japanese are you going to be in this moment, right?
Yeah, and I wonder if you would even be thinking that if you hadn't seen the 2024 version.
Totally not. No.
Right?
I wouldn't, because I don't know who Yabu is. I don't know that he's...
But also, I guess it's just as valid to say that some of these things are just little nods for the book readers. It's not important to understand Yabu, but, like, if you read the book, you're like, oh, all right, this is him being... So it's like, you know.
This is super Yabu.
And this, the other thing is, I noticed for the first time that Richard Chamberlain is essentially a Christ figure, because in this robe, with this haircut, with him on his knees sweating and supplicating, and it's very trying to sacrifice himself to atone for a whole village's sins. I think Richard Chamberlain did play Jesus Christ in an earlier production.
Oh,
and
it
really comes. Wasn't he Jesus Christ in The Last Temptation of Christ?
I'm completely unfamiliar with Chamberlain's work.
Or maybe like I don't know. But the other thing is, like, they make a fucking meal out of this scene. There's 5 minutes of, you know, crash zoom shots of Yabu going like, oh, and Blackthorne like trembling with the sword to his breast, and Mariko going, ha, and Omi going, ha, and it just goes back.
Well, I mean, this is supposed to be a rebirth for this character into the Japanese way of thinking, which seems entirely unearned and way too early. That's the problem. Like, when Blackthorne does this in the 2024 version, he is on a precipice of understanding everything anyway. And this is kind of the final straw, right? This is the act that fully brings him across the line. And I think to do it like here halfway through, where we barely even understand the Japanese society, let alone his relationship with it, is just a huge mistake. It's not earned. It doesn't have the impact that the 2024 version does.
Yeah. And I'm guessing that this is more close to the book, and that they wisely put this at the end of his character arc, which works more better because there's so much more reserve between him and Toranaga, where here they're like goddamn drinking buddies already.
True. Can I ask you this? Maybe I'm just not remembering the scene correctly, but I'm pretty sure Blackthorne has not seen the act of seppuku yet.
Pretty sure, no. Like,
so the hell does he know, like, to pull his robe open, to lay the sword out in front of him, to hold it at this exact
angle?
Honestly,
he almost does a better job of seppuku than the actual Japanese guy did in the previous episode observing the front. That's a good question, because he could possibly be aware of... he could possibly be aware that seppuku is a thing, because that's how, you know, Fuji's husband and the son
as a concept was killed, certainly, but I can be aware of driving as a concept, and I can't step into a car and drive.
Right, and it doesn't look like he's like, if anything, is committing like what it looked like a woman's seppuku, where you stab yourself through the heart rather than slice your belly open. So maybe he just, you know, I don't know. That's a bewildering thing, honestly.
Or maybe this is just how
it's very dramatic. But I'm trying to think, like, how do you and television wasn't what it is today, but how did people stay engaged throughout this particular episode, not understanding the stakes of anything? Or is it just like enough that, like, oh, look at these sexy Japanese and they're giggling at the they're just savage and they're willing to kill at will and all this other stuff.
I mean, there's a base drama here too, right? Which is this man that I've come to like over the course of these 4 hours is gonna kill himself. Oh my god, I don't want that.
Really weird how they built him up to have this regal bearing that we both commented on in the first episode, and they trade it all away by having him be a buffoon scene. And be kind of sex obsessed, but then also greatly offended that anyone would suggest that these women, like, I don't know. Maybe he's offended that these women were there just to please him, and he thought he was like winning them over organically or something.
Oh yeah, like when you find out that your waitress doesn't want to go on a date with you.
Yeah, like I thought I was rizzing these people up and they're just Hooters waitresses. Shit. So I, throughout this whole discussion, I'd forgotten that that the books were different this way, but Blackthorne's trying to trade his knowledge of guns, which is how a lot of naval personnel refer to their cannon. And in the next scene, he's just teaching them to shoot flintlock rifles. And this obviously is ahistorical. We talked about this.
But they already know. We've seen them already knowing how to use these weapons. What is he teaching them here? I can't even understand it.
The weapons they had before, like these blunderbuss looking things, they're not nearly as accurate as the flintlocks. But here's the other thing is, like, their shooting range was like 25 feet. Like, okay. Buntero could honestly say my arrow flies faster and truer than these fucking guns, and I can shoot them far faster. Like, yeah, the 2024 version of Shogun has this hands down, but I understand that this was the flaw of the original material too, that Clavell just didn't have when guns were introduced and what advantages they might have. And the 2024 is just way better the way they handle this. So this next, we're getting towards the end, this episode, and there's this scene where, Blackthorne is getting religion about baths, and then Lady Mariko comes in and explains that there is no shame in the Japanese body, and
as
we don't have any privacy.
Cloth over her lap to hide her parts. Yeah.
Yeah, she jumps in naked, and it's pretty provocative and sexual
in
terms of 80s television, and it's erotic. It's erotic.
MacGyver never did anything like this, yeah.
Hell no. But she explains how they don't have any privacy because there's so many of them stacked on top of each other, and that's why they find little ways to carve out, and their language has so many ways to politely decline a request and without causing problems. Then there's a mysterious courtesan that visits him at night, which is obviously Mariko. And then they have a very painful, belabored conversation about the next morning, where Mariko patiently says, "You remember I explained I was married and it would be death if we had adultery. But, you know, if a servant girl of mine came in and had sex with you, it's no one cares." So that's what happened. And he's like,
takes him a good 3 minutes of conversation to understand what she means, but
it also is much more definitive, where they trust the audience to get it in the 2024 version. And the fucking wind chimes. Oh my god, they're in the sex scene at night. They're not even in a garden. What the fuck is this wind chime going off incessantly?
I mean, they're paper walls, man. You're gonna hear wind chimes wherever you are.
That's true.
You skipped what I got to say is very skippable in this show.
There's like 30 minutes. So I don't think I took a note, because I'm like, this is
same here. My notes are, oh my god, I really didn't need an extended language lesson. And we get like four of those over the next 30 minutes.
I wanted to ask you this because that's the other thing I found ridiculous as a modern person, that Mariko's statement that Japanese very simple compared to English. We just, every verb is conjugated the same exact way. You know, if you're, if it's that's this, nice. And then if you want to know if someone's doing something, you add a ka, and if you want to, you know, you add it a on, and is that really how it goes?
But they look, can't, because I'm on my 145th day of streak on Duolingo for Japanese, yeah. But yeah. I'm mostly concentrating on the language, the alphabets. As I understand, yeah, like the verb conjugation is way simpler. But so I don't think there was anything in this that I would claim.
Okay,
because
that blew
but I don't
my
know
mind.
That much, so
that blew my mind. I thought that, like, I've heard that Japanese and Chinese and many of the other languages are based on kanji and character are
the tone
way harder to learn.
I have not gotten into the tone stuff with Japanese. I didn't know that there was tone stuff. That was new to me. But the conjugation of certain things, like adding ka at the end to make it a question.
Yeah, that you can go from like, give me a piece of coffee, give me some coffee, you piece of shit, to my most honored lord, please give your humble servant a cup of coffee just by a slight tonal inclination. And I buy that. Like, that's a perfectly cromulent perhaps way to communicate, but...
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know if that's in there. But I definitely didn't need the lessons. I can understand as he starts to gradually speak more Japanese that he has learned this somewhere. He's not picking this up somewhere, but I don't know. I think they handled that
better.
Maybe
it's easier to speak at like a base course level than it is to like, because like then you got to learn like the written language and
of which
all
there
that
are
stuff
multiple
works. And yeah, it's like the alpha, you know, having 26 letters, the alphabet's pretty sweet.
Yeah. when you start to look at the Japanese phonetics, you understand why Blackthorn would be such a hard name to say, why it has nine extra syllables and like,
yeah, and it's also the L's and the R's that they don't have. Yeah. I'm because I you're in you're on day 150 of Japanese and I'm on day 50 of German, and
oh,
yeah,
boy.
it's rough when you come across a phenotype that your language doesn't have in its mother tongue.
Yep.
And it's like
in Italian, there's this li sort of GLI letter that is almost impossible to say for me as American.
And I thought the one thing with Germans is that they wouldn't trill their tongue because it's all, because I can do the guttural thing, but like I can't trill my tongue to save my life. And the pronouncing is correct, you got to trill a few of the R's and. So yeah, I you know, like I, it's not that it's just the accent. They don't have that the R and the L the way we do. So they have a very hard time getting it out. They don't have any practice with it. And oh shit, this Mariko, I guess in real life this actress didn't speak a word of English and she learned on the job. And I guess you'll notice at the end of production, she's actually a lot cleaner in her English. But it's pretty
impressive.
Like she speaks in very heavily accented broken English, which is completely different than the very literary cultured way that our Mariko is able to speak. Because, you know, she's started learning it when she was in her teens. Like I got the idea that she had, like, you know, spent a decade, if not more, like 15, 20 years speaking English by the time she meets Blackthorn. Whereas
that's the thing. And if you want to believe Martin, Father Martin, when he says, oh, yeah, I was raised on this stuff and I speak it as naturally as I speak my mother tongue, right? You have to also believe that Mariko could, but she clearly doesn't.
Yeah. And again, they have like, yeah, there's a lot of time that Father Martin had to explain that, like, yeah, I've lived with these people all their life. I can speak their language as a native, but I don't understand them. It's just too impenetrable to understand how they view things. And but yeah, we didn't have, I was expecting another cliffhanger, but the only cliffhanger is John Blackthorn being slightly confused about the nature of the person he pillowed with. God, I hope because this was funny. I actually literally found it funny to see some of the differences and seeing Torinaga dance like a lunatic. And because he does that also, there's a scene where like the camera's kind of lingering of him on his castle and he just starts doing the dance on the castle wall.
That's,
and I'm like,
the callback I didn't like. Yeah. It was too much. I could see a man who, you know, has a rich personality and gets up and dances a jig with this guy and learns some custom because he's a curious man. He wants information. But
yeah,
to have him do that, at the callback was too much.
It's just a different Torinaga experience altogether. So I'm hoping. But the thing is, like I worried that, like, you know, we talked about, like, I don't know how some of this stuff is going to play because they just haven't set any of the Japanese stuff up. And we saw that that is where a lot of the sins of this 2 hours of adaptation lie. They haven't done any better job. So it's like, I'm wondering if this is just going to constantly be, you know, like a source of bewilderment about how things and why things happen and when things happen. And like, we didn't meet Ishido until he looked out to be a buffoon. We know nothing about the Christian lords. We don't know any.
I think this is a very different experience from, more so than I expected. Here's what I'm getting halfway through is the people who were saying, oh, there are some differences here and there, were underselling it. There are massive differences in these two shows, these two adaptations. I saw the 2024 version first, so of course that's going to be my touchstone, right? My reference point.
I can see how you would, if you're a fan of the book and the 80s show, you would be sad to see some humor that you liked in the book to be missing from the show and vice versa. But like, I didn't think that 2024 Shogun was missing its humor. Like, it's just entirely supplanted.
Just more focused.
Yeah, like Yabu's a clown, but he's a clown that in a much more serious, sinister type of way. But I don't know. Maybe they'll come around to it. I'm still going in with an open mind, and it's nothing that this show can make 2024 Shogun any worse in my eyes. It's just I was hopeful for something that I was literally just going to be like, yeah, this is just a different version, and I'm getting some things that I wouldn't have got out of this one. And this was a lot of groaning and shaking my head and, oh my god, what, this is not my Torinaga.
Yeah. I am hoping it's a little less silly going forward and we've got some more serious subject matter coming up, so we'll see. But the one thing that I don't think is going to change is their method of storytelling, and that's going to cause friction for me the entire
way
through.
And it's like, there's probably not going to be the big earthquake because I wouldn't even know enough about Torinaga's forces to understand the impact of it. Do you think they're going to have the Buntero Mariko drinking scene? And
No. No, I'm going to say it's going to be different. Much like the race scene was left out and it was still like the same thing was accomplished, but different. It'll be different. Yeah.
I'm trying to think. There's several, like the Red Wedding episode where his brother, half-brother, betrays him and Nagakata gets killed. I don't see how they can do any of this stuff.
It'll be Orson Welles saying, and Seki told his brother that the armies were outside and he was to escort him to Ishido, betraying the man they once loved. Yeah. You know, it'll be that sort of thing.
Yeah. The other thing is, like, there. At what point does Mariko become a serious character and not just a, like, waifu fuck doll for Chamberlain? Because, like, that thing is, Chamberlain does, like, how can he love her? He doesn't know her. I don't know her.
We don't know her. That's the problem.
Yeah, like, she's just attractive and submissive and speaks in a halting English accent.
Teaching him their customs.
She's attracted to him. That was the whole bath scene, like that. But I don't understand why she's attracted. I guess him sticking up for the village, like, that seems crazy to her. But also, it's something like, you know, I've never seen a man do something like that, but I kind of like it. He's different. He's different than my Buntero guy.
Yeah, the pieces are all mostly there. It's just that there's a form here that is not quite what I want out of television here 44 years after the original was made.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think that's about it.
Okay, if you would like to send us some feedback, you can do so, shogun@baldmove.com. You can also follow us along on our social medias @baldmove. And if you want to contribute to us, support us, keep us doing the bits, keeping the bits flowing, keep us doing podcasts, and get some nice bonus features for yourself, extra content, ad-free feeds, support.baldmove.com. We'd love to have you.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
And now, back with more Bald Move. All right, let's start off with Daniel, who says, very happy to listen to your Shogun Finale pod when I was on a train from Osaka to Kyoto, which this is pretty good. He watched the finale of Shogun on the bullet train, the Shinkansen from Edo, Tokyo to Kyoto. That's very thematic. After hearing your discussion on judging the Japanese historical figures retrospectively, I want to give you some insight I was given from one of my Japanese guides here. At the tour of the grounds of the Osaka Castle, I asked the Japanese guide who are the revered historical figures, like our George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, those guys. He said there were three. Oba Nobunaga, ruler immediately before the Shogun story, the Taiko, which we know that guy from the Shogun story, and Torinaga, which is actually the equivalent of Tokugawa Ieyasu. And he said all three are heavily revered in history. He did differentiate slightly West versus East. He said in the West, in Osaka, the generally merchants and entrepreneurs favoring the Taiko who built the original castle and, although lost in Korea, unified Japan more completely. He was the one who gave Osaka its importance. In the East, Tokyo, generally samurai and upper class with more attention paid to order, favoring Torinaga who built Edo, Tokyo. I found it interesting because in Kyoto Castle, there are three floors filled with letters, weapons, and armor. Each floor, I read dozens of handwritten letters by Toyotomi, and I was expecting the next floor to feature Tokugawa, and it never came. Tour guide said if I wanted to see artifacts about him, I should go to Tokyo.
If you want to see that bastard, go back to Tokyo.
He probably said it with a different tone. He probably said, oh yeah, if you want to know more about that guy, they have a lot in Tokyo. Anyway, the main battle detailed at the castle, this summer war of Osaka in 1615, is when Tokugawa brutally crushed and destroyed Toyotomi's family line.
Spoilers for season two of Shogun.
Right. As an American, I reflected how intricate and interesting Japanese culture was and how weird it would be if the frame was swapped. Imagine a Japanese fictional novel set at the American Revolution with slightly changing the names of George Washington or Thomas Adams. Hope this enhances your continuing coverage of all things Shogun.
You know,
yeah, I feel like those nuances exist, but I appreciate seeing them here.
Has that never happened? There's never been like somebody from the Czech Republic that wrote a fictional history set in America with Geoff what's a good like Czech name? I don't know.
Wachowski, I don't know.
It have a lot of Y's and G's and Z's in it. I know. Mm-hmm. You know, but like I that's had to have happened, right? Or like someone in Japan wrote something about a Japanese sailor that got shipwrecked on. Maybe yeah. Not. I don't know.
Probably somebody somewhere is writing American fanfic.
Yeah, or critique or try and cultural understand. I think it would be, I think it's a cool idea. And it's also something where it lets you get away from the literalness of history. Like, oh, well, the real life, Nobunaga, he didn't do this, or the real life Mariko, if you just slightly change their names, then you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. You can change times and dates and significant events and motivations, and probably why Clavel did it, I would imagine. But I think it's interesting how regional, like if there's a rivalry, like a sports team.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like
this is a guy that founded our city, or, you know, made our city into what it is. So we love him.
Yeah. Do not like this Tokugawa guy in Osaka, okay?
Apparently
have some
not.
Problems. If you want to read his letters, go to Edo, okay? That's super interesting. Although I also thought it was funny when he's talking about taking a bullet train and hearing insight from his Japanese guide. Is like, was his name Bentaro, and did he insist that the arrow can fly faster than the train?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Pick a side of the train station when he gets offended. Well, thanks. Yeah, I appreciated that insight there. Let's move on to Chris. Absolutely loved your coverage on the show. I laughed, I cried. As a book reader, you've helped me work through some real trials and tribulations this show has put me through. I feel like I'm going through that in reverse watching the show, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in reading the book to see, because I keep on hearing the show is so faithful to the book, so much more faithful. The 80s show is so much more faithful to the book than the 2024 version. I'm very curious to see how much of the changes are like budget, adaptation. Surely there's a lot more of the Japanese characters content in the book, I would hope. Mm-hmm. He says, as part of the preview podcast, Aaron mentioned that Shogun is one of his dad's favorite books. So I was curious if Aaron is surprised now knowing the story, if he's had a chance to chat with his dad about John Blackthorne, M to the A to the Rico, Yaba shitbag, and all the rest. I tried to talk to my dad about Shogun, and he didn't have much interest in it. I tried, it's like, you know, that the Shogun, yeah, it's like there's a new one, it's on Hulu. I don't know how to watch that. And I'm like, it's FX. Thing. I'm sorry, okay. It's FX. I'm like, I know you've got it on demand. You could watch it right now, and I don't know, he acted like he didn't know some of the characters I was referring to. But the other thing is, like, my dad is old, he's like 78 now, and he's starting to kind of slip, so yeah.
And it
unfortunately
was his favorite 40 years ago or whatever, so
yeah,
sure, if he hasn't engaged with it in decades, I understand.
It'd be weird, though, if I forgot all the plot of the Matrix or the Lord of the Rings books or something like that when I'm 78. But I don't know. His generation is different. Like, his generation was very much like, once you grow up, you put away your comic books and you become a totally. Man and you don't do the, you start drinking beer and watching sports. But
yeah, aren't childish. All right, let's move on to Nate, who... Well, you probably expect it by now. He wrote a Bible. I'm going to give it its due because, you know, we don't have all that much feedback. So now's a good time to really slide that Bible in. He says, well, just listening to your first two House of the Dragon book to show comparison episodes, and the thought occurred to me, isn't House of the Dragon the perfect example for if the Shogun production team wanted to make a second edition? As you might have seen, we had a heated but friendly discussion on Discord. Many people want more Shogun-related content, but some people understandably are concerned about if they were just going to churn out a crappy season 2 just for the money grab. My position all along has been that they should not jump to any of the Clavel's other books, but should stay in the Shogun world. However, this season of Shogun wraps up so perfectly that continuing that story from the end of episode 10 would be anticlimactic. I think a better idea is to make an anthology series of different moments in Japanese history. I don't think Western audiences would be ready for an all Japanese cast and 100% subtitles, so it would have to be set after 1543 when the Portuguese first arrive. I like to think he's selling the American TV audience as short, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, if you're talking about... Right. Prestige television on, you know, like FX, Hulu, some of the kind of prestige networks. I don't know that would be a crazy idea.
Yeah,
you could always offer a dubbed version if you wanted to, kind of like they do.
Like Hulu did, yeah,
with Prey, right? They had the Cherokee language. Oh, they had
Shogun offered like 9 versions of this thing with subs and dubs and all kinds.
Got you. I didn't know they even had a sub, but like or a dubbed version. But that's a way you could go if you were afraid of the ignorant American stereotype.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, he continues, maybe though it's that first arrival and introduction of the Western style guns, and we can change the image from the Japanese being amazed by boomsticks to a more realistic, oh, okay, I see what this does, now show me how to make it. There's source material to draw from there with the records of the daimyo house that owned the little island of Tanegashima, where those Portuguese landed. Or maybe we get a different view of Kuroda. There's a novel by Kunio Tsuji called The Signore.
Kunio Translator is this guy's name?
What's that?
His name is Kunio Tsuji. That was the name that they called the Portuguese translator, Blackthorn of the Anjin.
I didn't realize that.
Father Martin was Tsuji.
I mean, that kind of makes sense. It's originally in Japanese, but there's an English translation. Told from the viewpoint of a Jesuit priest and covers the life of Oda Nobunaga, the historical Kuroda. They could show us a different side of Kuroda than the one that made Akechi want to kill him, possibly complicating the narrative we got this season. We'd also get a younger Torinaga and insight into Mariko's family, etc. I think I like this one the most. The text as we saw it.
Yeah.
That stuff is cool.
I noticed as I watched the first 2 episodes of Age of the Samurai, the show that Nate's a talking head in, and in they established that the counterpart of Torinaga, the Ieyasu,
that dude.
No, not him. The Torinaga, that he was a young man during all this stuff. Like he is already kind of distinguished himself as a warrior. And that would be a cool idea to have the rise and fall of essentially Kuroda, the Nobunaga guy, his fall. And then you could, if you want to set it in the Shogun universe, have a Kuroda and have it be his rise. See Torinaga as a young man and Mariko's father and how they decided to take the tyrant down and how the Taiko took over. Uh-huh. And you could do another one about the war in Korea. I think that sounds really interesting. This kind of doomed nationalist campaign they did in Korea and got thrown back into the shores of Japan. That would be an interesting.
Yeah, so that's actually the last suggestion that Nate has.
Oh
here.
Shit!
The last one. There's plenty. How about part of the Taiko's rise and reign, or even his invasion of Korea? Apparently, we were wrong on the podcast. Korea doesn't just kick Japan's asses, at least on the land. The Japanese landed, quickly rode roughshod over the Korean army, which was inept, and some Japanese units made it to the border with Ming China, but Ming China decided to come help the Koreans. Even then, the Japanese held their own on land. It was 2 things, the Korean navy and the guerrilla warfare by Korean peasants, eventually forced to cease fire, and then when the Taiko died, the Japanese landed, metaphorically landed the helicopters on the embassy roof and pulled out. They didn't have helicopters then, the late 1500s. Yes, it was Hideyoshi's Vietnam, but the actual flow of the war was much closer to the Korean War in the 20th century. So yeah, that could be an interesting one too. I would certainly be in for something like that. Get to see Ishido, you get to see Yabushige.
The Iron Fist.
Yep, Hiramatsu.
Iron Fist and guys, that'd be cool. No, I think any of those things, and I saw that those threads about people like insisting that she should just do one and done in Shogun. I don't know where that comes from. I can think of just as many prequels that were very, very good, and as I can, the ones were cash grabs. And I feel like, first of all, everything's a cash grab. They didn't make Shogun to advance the knowledge of Japanese customs for North Americans, right? They made it to fucking make money, to sell commercials.
Yeah, this is not a PSA.
So like, I feel like nowadays in this age of television that, look at House of the Dragon. House of the Dragon is arguably
well, I don't know, because it still has to be finished. But like, House of Dragons way better than the last three or four seasons of Game of Thrones, its parent show.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. Where it was having just tons of money lavished on it. So, and the history's there. Like the books aren't, in terms of like James Clavell. If you want, and it does seem like that the producers of this production don't really want to go and do all the research and spin up everything they need to do to like significantly move things around in terms of time and place and Japan. Whereas if they wanted to follow Clavell around, they would have to. So I'm all for them adapting the Age of the Samurai stuff, essentially. And you could even do like two seasons, like one on the Nobunaga, the first warlord, the guy who harvested the rice. You could do one on the Taiko and, you know, how he, you know, all these people that bring the dream of unifying Japan just a little bit closer. I think that would all be fascinating from what I can tell watching the documentary type material and just reading about it.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think there's a little nuance there about like, departing from Clavell's work and people, but it's really only people in the know who are going to care about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And they're going to watch anyway. It's not like, oh, this isn't based on a Clavell work, I'm out. They'll be enticed by whatever sort of anthology thing they do here. I don't know. It seems like a good idea.
What was Nobunaga's actual title? Because that would be cool if like you had Shogun and then you had Taiko for the theoretical season two of the prequel, and then season one was called Warlord, or I'm not sure exactly what his real life title was.
I mean, I guess he might have been a Shogun.
I thought Shogun
was like...
were a little bit older than that, but I wouldn't go against.
I don't think so, but Nate definitely knows, and I'm sure he'll write in with, you know, another chapter of his Bible.
I just looked it up. They call him a daimyo, which is just, you know, fucking Yabushiga is a daimyo. But also, I guess his title was the Tenka Bito, person under heaven. So you could have Tenka Bito, Taito, and Shogun.
Mm-hmm.
Joel says, listening to the 1980 Shogun podcast, and this article talks about what Aaron mentioned, 1980 Shogun had a pretty large impact on U.S. culture. This article talks about it in detail. This is from March 8th in salon.com. And it says, if you want another Bible, let me know and I get to typing it up. I've definitely been thinking about the large scale comparison between 2024 and 1980 and the book, but I haven't organized my thoughts and I'm not sure it's worth the effort. We're not either. But
I think as far, because we had, you know, a little discussion, but a fairly uninformed discussion. You know, we were both kids and or not born at the time of the release of Shogun in the 1980s. So I figure we could probably include this link in the show notes for people who want to read it and see what an effect America got from the show.
It's funny because it's like it's just as much like cooling the jets on Shogun, you know, Japanified America with giving it its due. It's like, I guess maybe it's one of those things where people underrated it and then after 20, 30 years overrated it. And now people are kind of like going back and properly rating it its historical impact.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it's interesting because the further you get from the contemporary events, I feel like the less reliable the history becomes. So, like, I'm almost inclined to believe the things that are written about it earlier than, you know, some retrospective that's done 40 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably the first television event that I can remember as a child. I was too young for Roots. Huh. Like it came out like when I was not even a year old. I definitely remember its re-release. But yeah, like all of our moms and dads were watching it. It seemed like it was on all the covers of TV Guide. The next one I can remember is B, the miniseries about the lizard people. Mm-hmm. But it certainly impacted the culture, I'm glad that it impacted enough that 40 some years later we can enjoy a better remake, or what seeming to be a better remake.
All right, let's go over to Matt from Philly, who says, I was a bit behind on the show, but I finally caught up in your last podcast for Shogun. While watching the show, I was reminded of a launch PlayStation 2 game called Kessen, which went on to spawn a second and third game in the series as well. After looking up Shogun on Wikipedia, it turns out that indeed Shogun is based on the real-life people that Kessen portrays as a strategy battle simulator. What's also interesting is the game had an alternate history type mode for it where you could play Ishido's side and see how things would have turned out differently had he won. So it was one of the few games we had when we got our PS2, and I was probably 10 or 11 at the time playing it, but I remember elements of it being funny even for the time. So, if you want yet another thing that spins off of Shogun here that you have to check out, who knows how many hours, this is a simulation, so you could probably sink as much time into it as you want. I don't remember this game at all.
Yeah, well, so this makes sense because I, like, as the Super Nintendo was getting old, I switched to PC gaming for like a decade, and I completely missed the PlayStation 1, the PlayStation 2. I was like halfway through the PlayStation 3 life cycle. I think it was pretty much around the release of the first Last of Us when I got a console and started console gaming again. So yeah, I had this is all news to me. It'd be available on PC and I still haven't heard of it, but
right. I had a Dreamcast. I don't know if it was available on Dreamcast, but that was my console choice that generation. So,
oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Everything got ported to the Dreamcast. It was the number one ported console of all times.
I think that was the PS2. But I'm pretty sure, I don't recall it being on there.
Richard from Sydney says, greetings from Australia, where we love your work, guys. Thank you. Always love hearing from our fans down under. Aaron and Jim had already commented on how long it seemed to take Torunaga to unfold the letter his wife had smuggled from Ochiba in the final episode. But did you notice how many lines we see him unfold from that piece of paper? Eight folds are unfolded. Holy shit. Immediately the camera has cut back to Torunaga after his wife says, what a suggestion. And at that point, the paper's already partially unfurled. But from there, in a single shot, there are eight unfoldings. Before we even hear a word about what is in the letter, the visual is telling us that Mariko's actions have pierced Ochiba through all eight folds of her fence. The war is over. That is great visual storytelling. Yeah. It's a lot of folds.
Yeah. Interesting if true. I didn't go back and verify it, but I'll take your word for it. That's kind of cool.
I thought it was impossible to fold a piece of paper more than seven times. No, that's in half.
No,
right?
That's phone books. Yeah, you can't fold phone books in half more than seven times.
How many times can you fold a phone book? God damn.
Six.
I don't know if I can name
it turns
once.
Out.
All right. Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to Kelly, who says, some thoughts after begrudgingly watching the 2024 Shogun, falling in love with it, and reading the almost 3,000 pages of the book, then getting the original on DVD. I have no more than snapshot memories of when it originally came out in 1980. I was nine, but my dad had served in Okinawa, so I'm sure we watched this.
There you go.
That's
how you hook the boomer dads. I'm serving right? Okinawa.
The 1980 production does not mention that women can be samurai, so Mariko and Fujiko are not samurai and have less status. It's also very faithful to the book, a little too much perhaps, comes from having the writer as an executive producer. I like the way the 2024 version rearranged some things and created higher stakes and deeper losses. Richard Chamberlain has Wi-Fi? What does that comment mean? Richard Chamberlain has Wi-Fi.
Let's not forget.
Did we say something?
Richard Chamberlain was in a closet at the time. Huh.
I didn't even know Richard Chamberlain was gay, but apparently he was throughout the
Richard
the,
Chamberlain
his life.
Has Wi-Fi. It seems like that's like I don't know what that means, like, cuz that's like slang for like being on the internet, I think. But
okay, but 1980s.
He's not.
Yeah. I don't know. You might have to write back in, Kelly, and let us know.
Does he check his BlackBerry in episode 3 or something that we haven't seen?
Yeah,
I don't know.
No, it's episode 2 while he's spinning around acting like a lunatic. I don't know. He's checking his phone.
Maybe that's what it is. He got hacked. He got exploited.
Also, this shocked me. I don't think I had known this before, but she says that title sequence that was awful. We all hated it, and it won an Emmy. That thing won an Emmy for title sequences.
The only thing that would make me absolutely stroke out is if this thing won a music or Emmy.
It probably because did.
This is the thing, like this. This show would be like if it's you know, I don't know if it's like a 60 or I'm not sure what's going to, because we've only seen half of it so far, but I feel like this thing, it would be a full letter grade improvement if you just rescored it or took out the music.
Oh my God, it got addition nominated by subtraction. For so many. Okay, I gotta sorry, I'm down a Wikipedia rabbit hole here.
Okay.
Let me read the list of Emmys that this got nominated for, and then I'll tell you the ones that it won.
Okay.
And this might take a while. Outstanding Limited Series, Outstanding Lead Actor in a Limited Series or a Special, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Limited Series
Mariko,
or a Special.
I'm assuming. I can buy
Shimada,
that.
I don't know who that is, but sure. Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Limited Series or a Special for John Rhys-Davies and Yuki Magoro. Outstanding Directing in a Limited Series for Jerry London. Outstanding Writing in a Limited Series. Outstanding Art Direction Limited Series. Outstanding Cinematography Limited Series. Outstanding Costumes. Outstanding Film Editing. Outstanding Achievement in Film Sound Editing. So not quite music.
Yeah, that's
Outstanding Graphic
know.
Design and Title Sequences.
Okay.
And
okay. I can rest
it
easy.
It won... So it won overall Outstanding Limited Series. It won Costuming, and it won Graphic Design and Title Sequences.
Costuming's pretty outrageous, but I guess if you're comparing the quantity, and I was looking at Toranaga, like the big people have some pretty nice costumes.
Yeah, they're fine.
But they're not as good as, yeah, like they're just, you know, we're just used to so much better costuming. Just in terms of the richness of the material, the way it moves and it's fitted, and I mean the budget's like, you know, like what? Yeah, let me. I'm on the Wikipedia page here. What was Shogun's budget? Do they list it here? $22 million for the whole fucking thing, which I guess is $70 million in our, like, what's the Shogun 2024?
That feels like a lot for television of the day, but.
Oh no, that's pretty lavish, but like still, like that's two episodes of House of the Dragon nowadays. I can't find a budget for the new one.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not seeing it. Ah, well. But yeah, my case in point is it's not unusual. I mean, shit. They spent $500 million on the first two seasons of Lord of the Rings: Rings of Power. I mean, now you can say a lot of shit about the Rings of Power, but you can't really knock them on their costuming and set design. Nope. And it does look like money. That show looks like money. Doesn't plot like money, but it does sound like it. And look like it. Layla says, just listen to the recap and y'all's interpretation of Achiba's ending to Mariko's Flowers Are Only Flowers Because They Fall poem. I have a somewhat different interpretation. Just as Mariko's line highlights the beauty and permanence and sacrifice of the flowers she seems to have modeled her life after, most likely the sakura or cherry blossom, Lady Ochiba's ending line, but thankfully the wind, brings to mind a breeze that stirs up and carries the fallen flowers through the air. Ah, yes, the flowers have fallen, but the wind picks them up and carries them beautifully to complete the cycle and honor the sacrifice. I think Lady Ochiba is the win here, picking up Mariko's sacrifice and giving it even more prominence and meaning to end her feud with Toranaga to usher the peace. These two friends carried each other so much, and this is the last act of respect and honor from one friend to another.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to change my interpretation. I'm a little bothered by the win, which is Toranaga's whole... but... Toranaga is not the wind, nor is he the one that creates it. He just studies it and knows how to use it. So that would make Lady Ochiba the wind, and he knows how to use, harness, direct her. So yeah, I like that. Like it's not referring to the winds that cause the flowers to fall, but the wind that animates the fallen flowers and gives them further meaning. Perfect.
Yeah. Like it a lot.
Fact, Talitha, go back and replace this take with mine from the last episode, because it's deprecated now. It's a bad take.
Yeah, and then cut this email so they'll never know we stole it. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Total theft of the listeners' ideas is what we strive for here at Bald Move. So if you'd like to send in for your more emails for further idea privateering,
then send it in to shogun@baldmove.com. That's going to do it for us this week. Hope you tune in next week for our further exploration into episode 3 of the Shogun 1980s miniseries. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.